From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
The former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan was the most powerful man in state politics. Now he's in prison. We'll look at the rise and fall of Madigan. And lawmakers are back at the State House to begin a short fall session. We'll talk about that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime reporter and observer. And our guest this week, good to have back with us, Ray Long, now retired from the Chicago Tribune, but still following what's happening. Ray, thanks for being with us this week.
Good to be here, Sean. Thanks for having me on.
So, Ray, Madigan now in federal prison. He was sent to Morgantown, West Virginia. And as someone who's followed his career for so long, even though we knew this was coming, his sentencing happened earlier in the year, so we knew this was going to take place. But it was still, to me at least, a bit surreal. I wanted to get your thought on the fact that Mike Madigan is now a federal prison inmate.
Both Republicans and Democrats thought Madigan would never be convicted of anything, indicted of anything, or go to prison. And now a lot of people are in disbelief still that he's there in prison. He tried to stay out of prison while he appealed the overall conviction. He was convicted of 10 of 23 counts, as you'll recall, back in February. Oddly enough, on Honest Abe's birthday, the conviction came down. And so a lot of people are still wondering what this means for the regular kind of trade-offs that go on in Springfield and where lobbying starts and where it ends, because his co-defendant in this case was Michael McClain, who was deadlocked on his counts in this case, but he is still going to prison because of another case involving ComEd. He was part of the ComEd 4 that went down earlier. Madigan will be headed to West Virginia now. And, you know, watching the guy from the top of state politics with all kinds of power, he's like this giant redwood that fell. And a lot of the landscape now in Springfield has changed because he is no longer on the scene, no longer calling the shots behind the scene, no longer controlling the legislation. And the parlor game that was going on every day, almost every minute at every location on every floor of the Capitol, of what's Madigan think of this or that, is no longer happening. You know, Madigan ran into trouble when he had several of his top aides caught up in Me Too scandals, and that was where his speakership began to crumble. When this was happening, we were writing stories about various scandals that were breaking out around him, not him himself, but around him. So we saw all of this start to weaken Madigan's grip on his caucus. The caucus rebelled. 19 people, many of them women, stood up and said, we're not going to give Madigan his 37th and 38th years as Speaker of the House. Madigan was ousted by his own caucus because he couldn't get the votes to be reelected Speaker after 36 years as Speaker, an American record. He served longer as Speaker than any other Speaker in American history. This is a gigantic fall for a guy who once had it all.
Yeah, Charlie, you've talked on the show before, since all of this came to light and the trial and everything else, that Michael Madigan may have just stayed too long. And do you still believe that?
Yeah, I think that's quite possible, because the time certainly changed, and the kind of the whole atmosphere. Ray mentioned the Me Too thing. Back when I started as a reporter, what was kind of accepted is, oh, that's just the way things are, in terms of lawmakers behaving improperly towards female staffers or towards their colleagues. That just kind of went on and people didn't think much of it. And I think that the times changed and the environment in which in which Michael Madigan came of political age changed dramatically. I first met Mike Madigan when he was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention back in 1969 and 1970. He struck me at the time as being a pretty serious guy, pretty much straightforward. Some of the delegates from Chicago, some of the were, I thought, kind of really goofy guys, but Madigan was serious. And then I got to know him, obviously, when he was elected to the General Assembly. He was a Democratic leader under Speaker Bill Redmond. Then he became Speaker himself. And I always thought that he was very, very meticulous about keeping track of things, watching what was going on. And the times changed around him. And the kind of stuff that was commonplace when he began as basically as a student of Richard J. Daley, that all changed. And I think, and I noted this, I was fortunate enough, honored enough to be asked by Ray to do a foreword to his very excellent book that's like a biography of Madigan, The House That Madigan Built. And I mentioned in the foreword that the two things that struck me about Madigan, I think this is still true, his two main goals, he never had any partisan goals. He was not somebody who was pushing for this idea or that idea. He was there to protect the city, particularly against suburban interests. And he was there to protect the legislative branch against overreach by the governor. And I think in terms of his public service legacy, those would be the two things that would stick out in my mind, the way he stood up for the city. For example, when Harold Washington gets selected mayor and they had the council wars up in Chicago and some of the anti-Washington people tried to get legislation in Springfield to take power away from the mayor, Madigan killed it. He said, no, we're not going to do that. And he also he impeached Blagojevich, and in the impeachment resolution, everybody would focus on the fact that Blagojevich tried to sell Barack Obama's Senate seat. But five of the indictments against Blagojevich, where he was basically violating legislative prerogative, he was ignoring legislative rules that were designed to limit the executive branch. He just took them as being kind of advisory. So I think on balance, yeah, he's in prison in West Virginia. How long he'll be there is unclear. There's a possibility that because of his age and his physical health, he could be released before he spends the full 7 years or whatever it would work out to be. But as I say, on balance, I would say he was a positive influence for Illinois.
And you mentioned his age. He's 83 years old. Ray, when you look back at somebody who's been in power as long as he was, almost anything that was substantial legislation that got through, became law in the state of Illinois over the last, I don't know, three plus decades, really is not, if not due simply to Madigan, he certainly allowed it to happen. You know, you can look at things like gay marriage, for example, things that some people thought maybe he wouldn't support, and yet it became law. So there is a lot of things there that people, I think, can find good with, despite some of what has happened here and to tarnish his legacy at the end of his career.
And I think that's true of a lot of governors and other politicians, too. You might not like everything they do, but there are things that you do like that they do. I think that was true with George Ryan, too, for example, who obviously went to prison himself. But he also was, you know, on the flip side, to get a lot of things done, he also launched this, or agreed to launch with the four legislative leaders, like $4.6 billion dollars in pork barrel projects to go around the state too. You can find good things from people because they need to also get reelected, and they also have this part of their character that they want to do something for the greater good. The issue with Madigan, though, was that, like Charlie said, there wasn't really this core set of beliefs that were ever really articulated. He stood up for labor. He stood against the Rauner effort to turn Illinois into a right to work state of mind, and he did many things that helped the schools find money and the city find money when they were in dire straits. So you can point to a lot of things that he did, but the main thing he wanted to do was hold on to the speakership. And he was flexible, I believe, in his overall ideology, if there was one, but by trying to help out his members in ideas and legislation that became popular. And Charlie mentioned gay marriage, or I can't remember which one of you mentioned gay marriage, but he helped round up votes for that at the end of the day. And that was something that was important to his caucus. And if it's important to his caucus, he wants to help his caucus so he can get their support to maintain his leadership. And so there are many examples of that, not just gay marriage, but, he's also a guy that ended up supporting the banning of the death penalty. And he came out of this kind of conservative enclave on the southwest side of Chicago, where you might not think that a guy like that would go for either one of those types of topics.
Charlie, there's also, I remember when Blagojevich was convicted, and I thought to myself at the time, the arrogance of somebody, though, who's watched George Ryan be sent to prison to be doing stuff, actually maybe even more so than George Ryan. Now you see this with Madigan. He has seen people go to prison. He has seen federal crackdowns on corruption in government. Is it arrogance to believe that you can get away with it while others couldn't?
I'm not sure that would necessarily apply to Madigan, because as I'm not sure there was that same amount of people being arrested and sent to prison when Madigan started out as has developed since then. So as I say, the notion that if you're an elected office, you're supposed to do things for your constituents, you're supposed to help them get jobs, you're supposed to help them cut through bureaucratic red tape, you're there to serve them, and you look out for your allies, that kind of thing has always been the case. And you try and get something for your district. If there's a tough vote coming up, you're going to try and get something that you can bring home to your voters and say, well, yes, I voted for X, but on the other hand, I got you Y. And so that's always been the case. And I think, as I said earlier, I think the kind of the rules of the game changed, and Madigan never adjusted to them. Because if I'm not mistaken, the charges on which he was convicted all were fairly recent. There was nothing going back decades. It was all, and Ray, you know this a lot better than I do, but I think it was when the indictment came down, it was 2022?
Yeah, it came down in 22. It covered a period from 2011 to 2019.
Yeah.
With the ComEd scandal. And just to recap the charges that he was convicted on, he was convicted of working with McLean to get some of Madigan's precinct captain allies onto a third-party contract that was set up through a ComEd lobbyist, Jay Doherty, who was a lobbyist up here in Chicago for ComEd. ComEd would send extra money to Doherty, not say in any of the contracts that it was to be funneled out to Madigan allies, and eventually $1.3 million went to these Madigan allies, and they didn't have to do much of anything for that money. that was considered a bribe in the sense that Madigan was also overseeing the legislation that ComEd was thirsting for to help its own line its own pockets, and as it's turned out, has been a windfall for the company. That's one part of the equation. The other part of the equation that drew convictions were that he was called out by prosecutors for trying to work with Alderman Danny Solis, who was zoning chairman in Chicago, and trying to guarantee that or work with Solis to get a state post worth maybe six figures once Solis retired from the city council, and Solis would agree to help Madigan find folks who could help his real estate firm that does property tax appeals. And the big marquee count of racketeering was not guilty. And so what we ended up here was Madigan being viewed as crossing the lines on, and these lines are vague, but he should have known, for example, where they were, and that's what the prosecutors said, and that's what they eventually got him on. Now, there have been decades and generations of Madigan sycophants who have said that he would never cross the line. He was always a straight arrow on everything, and he gave that air of appearance, and for most issues, he probably was. But when it came to shifting from the idea of actual patronage in government to trying to find jobs for his people and precinct captains in the private sector, there became a conflict there that the jury said that he crossed the line and did things that were illegal.
Well, just to wrap things up, too, he is still appealing his convictions, may not have heard the last of this case, so we'll continue to follow where that goes. Let me move on. Legislature back in session to start the fall session. A couple of weeks they're going to be in here in Springfield. In fact, this is the first week of that. House Speaker Chris Welch said there could be efforts to pass restrictions on ICE, such as where they could do enforcement actions, maybe limit that, not at courthouses, not at hospitals.
That could be done in a veto session if they can agree to the language and move it. That it sounds like something that's at least got a populist ring to it and some practical issues that can be wrapped into it too. And so the legislature's ability to throw up roadblocks on ICE are limited, but this is one thing that he thinks he can do.
And Charlie, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it was one of the things that Welch pointed out is they wanted to figure out something that would, and here's a quote from the speaker, the things that we're looking at, we want to make sure that they have teeth, that they're substantive, and that they are enforceable. And so that's the bottom line. He said, we don't want anything that's symbolic. We want to do something substantive. And the big question, of course, is whether a state government has the ability to regulate what federal officers do. And a second question, at least in my mind, is even if the state comes up with a law, will the Trump administration follow it, or will they consider, well, this is just, you guys mouthing off and we'll do whatever the heck we want to?
Ray, you were also part of an effort, journalism groups going to court over some ICE tactics. Fill us in on that.
Yeah, I'm a member of the Chicago Headline Board of Directors, and the club filed a lawsuit along with several other news organizations that said, look, we don't believe that these federal agents, whether it's ICE or whoever is working with them, should be firing pepper balls at reporters who are clearly just one woman for a TV station was just driving by the facility when no action was happening, no protests were really going down, and she got fired with pepper balls and got gassed. And there have been other cases where several reporters have been tear gassed, et cetera. It was a suit that included also protesters and preachers. There was one preacher who was standing there basically begging for the ICE folks on top of a building to, you know, think about what they're doing and, I guess, repent. And they fired a pepper ball that hit him right on the head. I mean, the videos are just dramatic, and he is one of the people that was used as an example in this suit, and the judge came down and said, you know, stop doing this stuff. You're not supposed to be doing this. Americans have the right to protest, and, you know, if you go over the line and you break the law, go ahead and arrest people. But these are people covering stories and people who are sounding off their opinions and protesting, and there is no reason to be attacking them in any unprovoked nature at all. Now, obviously, there have been some other run-ins up here in Chicago where ICE has been dropping tear gas, et cetera. There are other temporary restraining orders that have been put into place to try to bring back or rein in, rather, the things that the Trump administration was trying to do, like deploy National Guard troops from Texas and Illinois to control what they were suggesting was a rebellion, and the judge just didn't buy it. It wasn't a situation where we have an actual rebellion or any of the kind of over the top statements that are being made by the Trump administration about what's going on in the streets of Chicago. There are TROs flying left and right. One thing that did happen just on Tuesday night, right before midnight, the feds took down a fence that they had erected without any warning or any notice ahead of time around the facility in Broadview, a suburb of Chicago, where ICE has detained a variety of folks who are viewed for not having documents that back up any reason for them to be in America. So this is a situation where the governor Pritzker and Mayor Johnson have both said that the feds are creating the chaos here, and we don't want them around. And the Trump administration says, well, there's too many people getting killed in Chicago, and the crime is too high. And they paint it as if we're in a war zone, which, if you walk up and down the streets of most neighborhoods, you can do it peacefully without worrying about any kind of problems. There are some neighborhoods that are much rougher, but the question is whether the federal agents are going after the worst of the worst that they said they were going to go after. And meanwhile, we're seeing people who are taco vendors getting arrested. So it's an extraordinary situation here, and what is happening, what the federal government is saying that is happening here in Chicago doesn't match up with what is happening on the ground and in reality as the judges have ruled.
Well, we're about out of time, but I do want to leave time for our notes from the field, and we're going to do a little something different this week. Charlie, I'll let you start it off, but we're going to talk about a case that Ray actually helped cover. But some more action on this case happened this week. So fill us in, Charlie.
Yeah, well, the Illinois State Board of Elections will be asked next week, I think on Tuesday, whether it should go along with a hearing officer's recommendation to fine Senate President Don Harmon $9.8 million for accepting campaign contributions in excess of campaign finance limits. And the board will hear a recommendation from an attorney who was appointed to study and rule on Harmon's appeal of the original fine. And I'll let Ray describe the ins and outs of it. But the bottom line is, it'll be interesting to see what happens because the State Board of Elections is made up of four Republicans and four Democrats. And it requires a majority to do anything. And should the board split and vote on partisan lines 4-4, then the fine would actually remain in place. So it's sort of a complicated situation. It basically has to do with whether or not that you, if you're running for the state senate, if you can raise money that you, and you're running for a 4-year term, if you can raise more money than you would be allowed to during the 2-year period. And is that pretty accurate, Ray?
Yeah, basically, this deals with the campaign finance limit that was put on, and oddly enough, one of the sponsors was Don Harmon himself. And if a candidate gives themselves more than $250,000 in a statewide race or $100,000 in other races, such as Senate races that Don Harmon is involved in, then you lift the overall donation limits, and you can accept donations of any number of donations far beyond the limits. And so Harmon was told that he had lifted the limits during one period, but then that he believed that he could continue beyond the March primary. The board had said that March 24 primary, the limits went back on to his campaign, and he kept acting like the limits were off. And so he continued to collect unlimited amounts of cash in the amount of roughly $4 million during the period that the campaign limits on contributions were in place. When he did that, and the State Board of Elections sent him a letter saying he couldn't do that, and he kept doing that, that is what constituted the fine.
All right, well, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and longtime journalist Ray Long, also author of the book The House That Madigan Built. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.